Why don't we start the meeting? We don't have a quorum yet. As soon as we do, or someplace along the line, we'll have to call the meeting officially to order. But I think we need to start. And first, we're going to hear from Dr. Doug Wood at the Mayo Clinic, who's going to hopefully explain to us the payment system in primarily in Medicare that underlines everything in healthcare. And again, this first half of this meeting is hopefully educational for. Oh, we do have 11 now, so I'll call the meeting to order. And if Representative Murphy moves the approval of the minutes, any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? We've adopted the minutes. And Dr. Wood.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm happy to come and try to explain in a short time what is perhaps one of the most complicated payment mechanisms any of you might imagine. And so at your discretion, I'm certainly happy to be interrupted if there are points that need clarification along the way. By way of background, I have spent in my career more than 12 years in coding-related activities, serving as chair of the Coding and Nomenclature Committee of the American College of Cardiology and advisory member to the American Medical Association's current procedural terminology editorial panel, as well as serving two terms on the editorial panel, chairing the Minnesota Medicare Care Advisory Committee for another 12 years or so, and also serving two terms on the Practicing Physicians Advisory Committee for the Department of Health and Human Services. So I hope that familiarity might allow me to condense this relatively complex payment scheme into a couple of simple concepts. But besides talking about the payment for physicians, I want to leave you with a few thoughts about what it means for physicians who are in primary care, especially trying to take care of patients with many chronic problems, and what it means for organizations like the one you will hear from a little later today, who are trying to undertake very innovative ways of improving the care for their patients, especially their patients with chronic diseases. So I hope that at the end of this, then when you hear some of the difficulties that have been encountered by the good folks at St. Mary's Duluth Clinic, you'll understand then the perspective of where their troubles might be. Now, physician services in Medicare are covered under Part B of the Medicare program. Part B is actually voluntary for patients. Part A, which is the hospital insurance program of Medicare, everyone who gets to Social Security, in essence, gets enrolled in Medicare Part A. But if you want Part B coverage, which pays for physician services as well as some other services, that's voluntary. And there's an additional monthly premium that you pay. By law, 25% of the total costs of physician services under Part B have to be covered by beneficiary payments. And that's why some of you might be aware from your own families or from friends or other constituents that those premiums have been rising for the last several years at more than a double-digit rate, which is the first time in the history of the program, really, that the costs for these services have been rising so rapidly. Now, this system of payment is based on what's called the relative value system. It's actually called the resource-based relative value system because now, finally, the costs of each of these services has been based on a specific resource. When this started, actually, back in the early 1990s, very few of the 7,000 physician services actually had really any good information about the resources required to produce care. And so less than 300 of the 7,000 services were actually valued carefully. Now, there are three components of a relative value unit. There is physician work. There is then practice expense, and that is, in essence, the overhead to provide the service. That's space, equipment, staff, supplies, and then finally liability. So every medical and surgical service that is in the book, Current Procedural Terminology, has RVUs that are attached to that. And the makeup of those RVUs are these three components. Roughly, about half of the total RVUs are for physician work, about 45% are for practice expense, and about 5% covers liability expense. There are some exceptions, however. Sometimes the technical component of the or the practice expense is much higher. And that's the case especially when there are very expensive pieces of equipment that might be acquired for physician offices. Expensive things like echocardiography machines or radionuclide imaging machines or x-ray equipment or CT scanners or things like that. So in those situations, then the technical component, which is also a synonym for practice expense, can actually be a lot higher in value than the physician work. Now, from the perspective of how the RVUs are determined, a large committee made up of representatives of specialties who have seats in the House of Delegates of the American Medical Association is charged with creating the relative value units. This is the Relative Value Update Committee, or the RUC. Now, the RUC reviews very carefully using a standard methodology of trying to assess the time, the skill, the psychological stress, and the risks of physician work, how much each service is worth. They make a recommendation that goes to CMS in the summer of each year, and the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, CMS, can decide to accept the recommendation, modify the recommendation, or reject it outright. Sometimes, if they're concerned about especially the risk for fraud and abuse, they may decide not to even pay for the service and instead create an alternate code that they will put into the Medicare fee schedule when it is published in October or November, beginning for payment beginning in the following January. So ultimately, CMS is the final arbiter then of how the RVUs are determined. So here's the arithmetic that goes into how a service is paid. There is what is called a dollar conversion factor. And the dollar conversion factor is set each year, again, by CMS when they publish the fee schedule. The dollar conversion factor is used to multiply the number of RVUs for a service to get a base payment. Now, there is a little interesting adjustment that occurs that is called the GPCI, or the Geographic Price Cost Index. The GPCI is intended to reflect the differences in the costs related to producing care in different parts of the country. So if the average for the country is 1, the GPCI for Minnesota is a bit below that, about 8% below to be precise. There are some counties in the nation where the GPCI is 1.33, 1.34 for the same service. Now, I suppose we could argue that the reality of that difference. I would say that in the medical world, generally, we compete for a lot of the same services, same licensed personnel and the like. Generally, equipment prices don't fluctuate a lot from one state to the other. And in the Medicare program, anyway, wage scales are set heavily by the CMS. So there could be some debate about why there's so much variation, but this is the way that the program is set up and the way it works. So Minnesota physicians will get a little less for each service than their colleagues around the country. Now, let me share with you a little bit of insight about the relative values of different services. I've chosen two different services, and this comes back to an example that I discussed for a subcommittee of Healthy Minnesota, and I think which caught the chairman's eye, but I'm a cardiologist. And now it turns out that I'm not an interventional cardiologist. Those are the kind that take catheters and put them in arteries and blow up balloons and things like that. I was one of those at one time, but I'm not anymore. Now, in this circumstance, then, I've given you the example of an office visit for an established patient, which is 40 minutes long. And for a patient with known coronary artery disease or heart failure, diabetes, things like that, it might take me that long to do a really good job of reviewing why a patient is not doing very well, looking carefully at their medications, understanding why they're having trouble taking their medications, and then maybe making some adjustments or getting some help for them. Now, that could occur because they came to the office complaining that they're having more chest discomfort or more shortness of breath. Now, on the other hand, if I was so inclined, I could say, well, more shortness of breath, more chest discomfort, well, maybe there's a new blockage somewhere in the artery, and so one thing for me to do is to immediately go to a heart catheterization. Now, if I go immediately to a heart catheterization, that procedure alone, for the same amount of work, is going to give me nearly four times as much reimbursement. And if I should see something that I think might benefit from having a stent put in, I can increase that even more. In fact, the RVUs for putting in a stent will be more than 2.5 times the RVUs just for the angiogram. So when you add all of that up together, that's a lot of motivation to move to an intervention as opposed to a bit more time-intensive but less resource, less procedural-intensive discussion with a patient. So the point here simply is to let you know that despite what was originally hoped for in this relative value system, that cognitive services would somehow get more recognition and reimbursement, in fact, that has not occurred. So procedures still have significantly greater value than do the evaluation and management services or office visits. Another important thing here is that physicians are paid for doing more, not less. So in the Medicare fee schedule, there is a set of RVUs attached to every service. So the more of those you do, especially the more of them you can do in a unit time, so for an hour a day or 10 hours a day, the more you get. So for the same set of hours in a day, if I had, say, 10 40-unit slots, 40-minute slots, I'd get less than $1,000 if I did all of that in physician visits, but I could get $4,000 or more if I just decided to work doing procedures all day. Now, the other problem with Medicare is that Medicare will pay only for face-to-face visits. They don't pay for anything else. And another particular problem is that the payment for office visits is a little unusual in that if you look at the time involved in an office visit, the payment for that time is not linear. So somewhere after about 15 to 25 minutes, the dollar per unit of time reimbursement begins to flatten. So the longer visit relatively brings less money for the physician who performs that sort of service. Now, a few other considerations. If you are working to try to do something different, that is something you'll hear about, I think, in the following presentation, if you should determine that certain things are not necessary, you won't receive any credit for that. The Medicare program in particular does not go back and look at services generally and find out where things are not ordered as part of an evaluation management service and then give some credit to physicians. They instead are really quite prepared to pay a hospital additional amounts of money for the procedures done in the hospital. In addition, if you are working to improve the care of a population, a panel of patients, a group of patients with a specific disease like heart failure, there is no additional payment for that because it does not involve face-to-face visits. So if you undertake those activities as a physician group because you think it might be better for your patients or it might be better for your hospital to keep patients out of the hospital who don't need to be there, there is not going to be any additional reimbursement for you. And if you think of something really innovative, like saying perhaps it might be better to take care of some patients with heart failure in their homes, or in places other than the hospital, again, there is no credit. You would actually tend to earn more money if you would completely ignore the needs of the patients and let any complications occur because it's treating those complications in your clinic or in your hospital, especially if you're an integrated system. The overall net benefit to you will be much greater for simply doing an average or less than average job and letting those complications occur. Another significant application of this finding is that pretty soon medical students who might otherwise be interested in careers in primary care, family medicine, in general internal medicine especially, will pretty quickly get the idea that it is not so lucrative to practice in the office. And so we are already seeing family medicine programs around the country that are not filling, general internal medicine programs that are not filling. And in that circumstance, then, the pipeline of practitioners, especially for rural areas, is, I think, already in jeopardy. Now, one other very important implication for this payment system. Again, I mentioned earlier that the payment per unit time is not linear. So most Medicare patients actually have several chronic problems. They have heart failure or heart disease. They have diabetes. They may have some depression. They have a few other things. It takes a while to go through those things in the office. But for an established patient visit, once you get past about 15 minutes of time, then the relative reimbursement begins to decline and flatten. And so when you hear many people say, I don't have much time with my physician, one of the reasons for that is that there is not much incentive for physicians to actually spend the extra time with patients. It is actually better from the physician's perspective to try to deal with problems one at a time. One today, one next week, one the week after, or one today, one in a few days, one in a few days after that. There is no current real incentive for physicians to do a comprehensive job of taking care of patients with multiple needs. Now, there's some other important things in Medicare payment that have nothing to do with physician reimbursement but may be very important for, again, the project you're going to hear about a little bit later, and that is that Medicare continues to try to reduce the reimbursement for home health care. So nurses in particular, who could be very valuable in managing patients with chronic disease and who otherwise might be very willing to undertake careers in home health care, find that their reimbursement is also quite inadequate to cover their costs and to get them involved in that care. So, a few final thoughts. If we don't have payment for coordination of services, we won't be able to show any specific improvement in the performance of our healthcare systems. Without payment for home health care that could keep patients out of hospitals or for physicians' offices, we will continue to see the same number of complications or more. And the health of our patients and our families and our population won't improve. And unless we're willing to make some payment for non-visit care, then we will not be able to effectively address the problems of people with barriers to access. So it is possible for me to be able to look at a set of information that is transmitted electronically and render an opinion that can be helpful for a patient. But I won't be paid for it. So a quick example. A few years ago, I saw a gentleman from Newell, Minnesota, about 2.5 hours away from Rochester. The opinion needed was it safe for him to have surgery done? I could have done that by simply looking at the electrocardiographic report, the chest x-ray report, and the echocardiogram report. Instead, Medicare made him drive 2.5 hours to see me for something I could have done without that. And as I was amazed to learn when I walked in the room, three of his adult children came along. So I think you can see there's a potential disruption. So I hope that these examples will give you an understanding of how Medicare Part B works, the payment for physician services, and the problems that are related to the current methods. And as we think about how we might want to move forward in Minnesota, perhaps this will give you a better understanding of why people are coming and talking about alternate models of care and looking for different ways to do reimbursement. And so with that, I'll stop and see perhaps if there are any specific questions at your discretion, Mr. Huntley.
Thank you, Dr. Wood. And Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Dr. Wood, thank you. This has been very helpful. On your slide on implications, this last one, can you just give me a working definition of coordination of care under the first bullet, please?
Well, coordination of care here could be a circumstance where I have a patient with diabetes, and I noticed that on their blood sugar determinations that they sent to me either electronically, because glucometers now can do that, or they keep a diary and send them to me, it becomes apparent they're having trouble. And so I could do two things. I could talk to them on the phone about why they're having trouble, or I could arrange for a diabetes nurse educator to go see them. I could have them come in and see a diabetes nurse educator, or I could arrange for a consultation with an endocrinologist. So that's what coordination of care means.
Representative Murphy.
And Mr. Chair, Dr. Wood, if you could talk then about the implications in terms of payment with relationship to those different interventional choices. Thank you.
Well, right now, since that coordination of care, if I do that in the office without the patient present, I will get no reimbursement. There is no extra payment for me talking to the patient or arranging a follow-up visit. If the problem actually is that they've got a problem actually seeing things and they're drawing up the wrong dose of insulin, that could be handled even by a neighbor who is interested in the patient, or by some other resource. Now, that other resource may also not get reimbursed, but I certainly would not as a physician.
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Dr. Wood. You've done a really nice job of explaining a pretty complicated system. But I wondered if you feel comfortable also addressing how this also gets shown up in how our hospitals are structured and reimbursed as well, in that if you decide to do an invasive procedure, then your local hospital has a revenue source as well, where if you pursue less intensive non-technology invasive sort of responses, then that's a different sort of situation as well. And part of the reason why we're seeing cardiac units being added everywhere and not many mental health units being added.
That's very perceptive, and again, the Part A program is at least as complicated as the Part B, but in essence, if you take the more than 500 DRGs that define prospective payment on the inpatient side, very few of those actually have a net positive for the hospital involved, and those very few are usually procedural things, surgical procedures or things like cardiac catheterizations or implantation of defibrillators and things like that. Now, many hospitals will make the point that in order to be able to have a balance of income, they need to have the more lucrative procedures in place. Some believe that the growth of specialty hospitals, which look solely at these very lucrative DRGs, is also a specific problem and perhaps a form of a medical arms race. So that's a very different discussion, and I don't know how far we want to go with that in this meeting. I leave that to the chairman's discretion, but it's a very perceptive observation. I would say, too, that perhaps if you consider, again, the physician reimbursement, the way that it's set up is one reason that mental health services are not going to be very attractive to either primary care physicians or psychiatrists or psychologists or other allied health professionals who might serve this group of people with unique needs.
Representative Root.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Dr. Wood. And forgive me if these are really elementary questions. Looking back at the RVU, the RUC, the Upstate Committee, would part of the problem, which you just alluded to as far as payment for mental health care providers, for example, could that be addressed there? Could there be a shift towards reimbursing more for office visits versus procedures?
That's a very good question. Recognizing that at the RUC, the number of people who do office procedures is very small in proportion to the number of people who do procedures, that may be one reason why there has not been much more balance. Now, CMS has begun to recognize this along with the Medicare Payment Advisory Commission, MedPAC. And so for this year, the Medicare fee schedule actually incorporates an increase in the value of the RVUs for office visits. That increase amounts to about a 5% increase. Now, because the law that governs Part B says that if there is more than a $20 million increase in spending from one year to the other, you have to go back and readjust all of the RVUs to pay for that increase in one area, then after the RVUs for office visits were increased 5%, the new total was reduced by 10% as part of the rebalancing. the payment for the rest of that came from other specialties, in particular imaging specialties. So radiologists and cardiologists who do echocardiograms and other images saw the practice expense or technical component of their payment reduced significantly in order to shift dollars. So there are ways that you can do that. And when the RUC fails to do that, then CMS will try to do that by regulation, as has been the case this year.
Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Wood, and also looking at the geographic price cost index, so does Minnesota get reimbursed at a lower rate for Medicare? I'm probably getting...
Yes, for the same service, Minnesota physicians will be reimbursed less than physicians in other parts of the country where the gypsy is higher than ours.
And who decides
that? That's decided by the Centers for Medicaid and Medicaid Services each year when they set the fee schedule. So that's a regulatory issue.
Representative Abler. Oh, just for my members, we're punished for past success. And Senator Durenberger has suggested we could reallocate $400 billion in the system. I suggest try to reallocate $1 within the system and see how it goes, as you've heard. So. Representative Gottwald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know if you're the one to comment on this or perhaps some of the other presenters, but at some point, I know there has been discussion, at least toying with the idea of doing a per member per month kind of approach to things, too, more of an allowance rather than the current system, which, as Representative Abler correctly pointed out, penalizes us for doing a good job.
Yes, one of the considerations of per member per month has been to think about how you might create a kind of a base payment that could be a per member per month approach for the concept of coordination of care or a medical home concept. That would be very different than the current fee-for-service approach that really is the basis of physician payment. Now, we would have to do that. We'd have to do that probably in Minnesota. The most recently passed federal budget deficit reduction act does incorporate a demonstration project for the Secretary of Health and Human Services to explore that concept. But I should remind you that the Secretary has very limited power in demonstration programs, and so whether that could occur or not is still not certain, and it may be a long time before you go from a demonstration program to actual change in payment.
Last question from Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a question. Do you see any trends in physicians limiting the number of patients or Medicare patients or Medicaid patients, Medicare, limiting their practice to those patients because of the reimbursement issues?
That actually has been a concern raised over the last several years as the payment for Medicare has been flat. There has not been a large-scale loss of providers willing to see Medicare patients so far. However, the future incorporates some larger cuts in reimbursement based on, again, the law that defines this payment. And it may be that there will be a perverse effect of the hope for pay-for-performance, and that is Medicare's requirements for reporting information about quality may overwhelm small physician offices and make them simply say, I'm not going to bother collecting all of this information if it means less than 2% of my reimbursement. And so they might have a couple of options. They simply could decide not to participate in the data collection and accept a lower reimbursement rate, or they may simply say, this is the last straw. Finally, I'm not going to see Medicare patients anymore. It's hard for me to speculate about what might happen in that regard.
Thank you, Dr. Wood, for your presentation. And,
my privilege.
Coming all the way up from Rochester.
I was here today anyway.
Now we're going to hear from St. Mary's Duluth Clinic, which is a hospital and a large clinic that are in a single unit. And they're going to talk about their, hopefully, about their heart failure program. And would you, each when you speak, would you just introduce your name for the tape so we can pick it up and get it into the minutes?
First, I'd like to thank you, Mr. Chairman, and the members of the committee for inviting us here today to present our heart failure information. And I recognize that there is significant understanding of healthcare issues given the background of several of the committee members. I'm Linda Wick. I'm a nurse practitioner, and I'm manager of the heart failure program at SMDC. Ron Siebert is our director of cardiology. Dr. Tim Boddicker is a cardiologist and also co-medical director of the heart failure program. And Nancy Gilbert is one of the registered nurses that works in the heart failure program. I'll try this again. I'll start with just giving you a little overview of our healthcare system up at St. Mary's for those of you that are unaware. We're a nonprofit healthcare organization. We serve a region of about 450,000 residents in northern Minnesota, northern Wisconsin, and we also extend into northern Michigan. We have four hospitals with a total of 555 beds, 18 regional clinics. We have 400 physicians and 6,000 employees. We have 850,000 annual encounters, 40,000 emergency care and trauma center visits, 22,000 surgeries, and for our purpose today, included our cardiac procedures, 9,700 cardiac procedures a year. Just for comparison, how we compare to the other medical centers in the state, St. Mary's Medical Center ranks third in percent of uncompensated care, and uncompensated care is figured by percent of total hospital expenses behind Hennepin County Medical Center and behind Regents Hospital. We also rank third in the state for acuity level, and acuity level is a number that's given to the hospital that indicates how ill the population is that you're caring for. So I included where Mayo is, Fairview University, us, and Abbott Northwestern just for comparison. I thought I would include a nice picture of Duluth. It doesn't look like that today. It was very chilly up there. So our heart failure program was first introduced in 1999. The program is mostly managed by nurse practitioners, and Dr. Wood's presentation was a good segue into our presentation here today about the payment system. We work in collaboration with the cardiologists, and our program has grown, first starting at the main clinic in Duluth to our satellite clinics in Ashland, Wisconsin, Spooner, Hayward, and just this year we opened up a clinic up in Virginia, Minnesota, which is, of course, even north of Duluth. Currently, the program coordinates care for between 770 and 800 patients. So why did we develop this program? It was really born out of an honest understanding that we needed to improve our care for this complicated, very ill population. Dr. Carl Heltney, who was a cardiologist in the cardiac department at the time, was very frustrated with the fact that he just wasn't able to keep these patients out of the hospital and recognized that the rotating door of coming into the hospital and the emergency room not only impacted him as a physician because he had to come in the middle of the night and take care of them, but also impacted these patients and their families and the whole community, really. We recognized that the traditional medical model that only reimburses patients for or reimburses physicians for caring for patients in the hospital just wasn't working for this population, and also that it was inefficient. Having physicians spend the amount of time that's needed to care for these very ill patients, as you've heard, just doesn't work. This is currently the roles that we have. We have a medical director who's a cardiologist, Dr. Boddicker, also Dr. Soleil, who oversee the program and provide leadership. We also depend on the cardiologist for the accurate diagnosis and the accurate treatment plan. The day-to-day management is really done by nurse practitioners and physician's assistants with the help of registered nurses. The nurse practitioners see the patients in the clinic, we adjust their medications, we refer them for device therapy, and the registered nurses then come in after our visit and do the majority of the education, going over the medication list. Dr. Wood touched briefly on the amount of time that it takes to go over a patient's medication list. And these patients, as he said, also often have diabetes, and other chronic illnesses, and also often have a medication list of 15 to 20 medications. So to do that in a 15-minute time frame, you can't even get through the medications. And so this model allows us to spend that extra time with the patients, making sure they understand their medications, why they're taking them, and how they should be administering them. In 1999, we started with one nurse practitioner, one physician, one RN, and a CMA stands for a certified medical assistant. And currently we have six nurse practitioners and a PA, two physicians that are medical directors, six RNs, six CMAs, and we have three main teams in Duluth and three satellite teams. Really an interdisciplinary team. We have we follow clinical practice guidelines and clinical pathways, and also have computerized information system. That has been huge for us. We started this program prior to the electronic medical record that all the healthcare systems now are struggling with, and we built our own computer information system to track outcomes on these patients. And that was, I have to credit Dr. Heltney, that was through his foresight, recognizing that if we're going to do something different, we have to be able to show that it's worth the time and money we're putting into it. So the process is as follows. The patient has a cardiology consult before coming into the program. The majority of these patients are seen in the hospital initially because they've had an episode of decompensated heart failure, and cardiology is consulted. They are then referred to the heart failure program, and the nurse practitioner or PA will see them 7 to 10 times that first year to titrate medications, to do education, to work with lifestyle management issues. And then if we have them stable after the first year, we'll only see them 4 times a year after that. We make sure that they see their cardiologist and their primary care physician at least yearly. One of the resistances that we had when we started this program was from primary care wondering why, or worrying about that we would be taking these patients out of their circle of care. And really what they learned is that we get them back into primary care more frequently because all we deal with is heart failure. And these patients, as I said, have multiple medical issues. And so when we notice that their diabetes isn't well controlled, we're sending them back to primary care to be followed up on such. And so over time, primary care has really embraced this program and recognized that we're there to help them take care of their patients. We're not interfering with their care of patients. We have a structured educational content, a team approach to visits. We measure some different things here that I'll explain for functional status. One is called the Minnesota Living with Heart Failure Questionnaire Score. It's a questionnaire that patients fill out that asks them questions such as, how much in the past 2 weeks has your disease impacted your ability to care for yourself? Or do you feel like you're a burden on your family? Or has it impacted your financial, or is it causing financial difficulties? And they rate this on a 1 to 5 scale. And that really gives us in the heart failure program an idea of what's important to them. They may be feeling fine. Typically, they may not be short of breath and be able to, look like they're doing pretty good. But really what's a worry to them is the fact that they're a burden on their family. So it just helps us open up that discussion in a way that we wouldn't otherwise probably catch on to. We do a 6-minute walk. We monitor their heart rate, blood pressure, and oxygen saturation as they walk back and forth in the hall for 6 minutes. And the patients really focus on that number. We tell them how far they walked in 6 minutes. And it's been really fun for me to watch patients come in with their tennis shoes on, and they are ready to do that 6-minute walk. When they're feeling good, they want to make sure that they improve that number, even if it's only by 20 feet. Boy, that they're proud of that. We also document their New York Heart Association class. That's just a standard classification that tells you how sick these patients are. The New York Heart Association class goes from class 1 to class 4, class 4 being end stage. And also AHA, which stands for American Heart Association stage, and there's stage A, B, C, and D. Again, it's an indication of how ill these patients are. Most of our patients in the heart failure program are New York Heart Association class 3 or AHA stage C, which are sick patients. And then the PHQ-9 is a depression screening score. As Dr. Wood talked about, these patients oftentimes have depression as part of their chronic illness. And then we use telemonitoring for vigilance between office visits, and I'll talk a little bit more about that in just a few minutes. Some of the things that we've done as part of this heart failure program is we started a heart failure support group, which is educational sessions. We've had pharmacists talk, dietitians talk, and we had the heart failure patients help us design the content for this. We started with the focus groups, and we now meet quarterly. And we usually have about 100 people attend, patients and family members that come. They love it. It's their chance to, pick the pharmacist's brain, or one of our cardiologists is usually there, so they're able to ask the cardiologist one-on-one questions. We also developed a newsletter, and we print about 2,000 copies a quarter. We pass it out to people in our heart failure program. We also give it to inpatients who are hospitalized with heart failure. We use the telemonitoring scale. This is a home-based electronic scale. Not everybody in our program gets the scale, as you'll understand why in a couple minutes. The patients that are really the most fragile, the most ill, get the scales. And so that it's shipped directly to their home. They plug it into a phone jack and an electrical outlet. And then that information comes to our computer every morning. And so we're able to see what their weight is doing, if they're having some symptoms, and then act on that information without making the patient come into the office every day. We currently have about 170 scales in use. I put 151 scales because later when I talk about some of the financials, it's based on last year's data, which was 151 scales. When the telescale indicates that a patient is having a problem, the RN will call the patient and do the following. They'll do a nursing assessment, review their med list, go over what they've eaten. For heart failure, it's very important to watch the salt in your diet. And for most people, they think that means don't add salt. And what we find out is that they're eating pasties, for those of you who are familiar with northern Minnesota, which unfortunately are high in salt. And so they think they're doing a good job, but they've just eaten pasties for 3 days straight. And now their weight is up and they're more short of breath. And so it gives them immediate feedback that, no, I know you didn't add any salt, but what did you eat? And as the nurse goes over that diet with them, they recognize, oh, yeah, I did have this, and you know, pizza's not good either. And so it gives them that immediate feedback and allows the nurse to continually educate. I think one of the problems that we have had in healthcare is we think if we give people information, then we've educated them. And anybody who knows anything about education knows that what people hear verbally, they only retain about 10% of that. And most of the time, patients are given this information when they're quite ill, when they're in the hospital. So not only, you know, their stress level is high, their anxiety level is high, they're sick, and we give them all this information, and then we send them out the door and expect them to adhere to the information we've given them. So this telescale really allows us to continually educate our patients over and over again. We all have a diuretic protocol that the RNs follow so that they don't always have to track down the nurse practitioner or the physician to give this person more diuretics. Diuretics is a medication that eliminates extra fluid if the patient is retaining fluid. They make follow-up recommendations. Sometimes they will check on the scale, knowing that if they check that particular thing, like chest pain, for example, will always set off an alarm, just because they want to talk to one of the nurses. These are often elderly, older people, and they're lonely, and they know if they check chest pain, Nancy's going to call them and have a conversation with them. Is that a good use of time? No. But you know what's happening if they're not getting contacted? Those are the same people showing up in the ER. So what are the advantages? Some of these I've already talked about. It facilitates early intervention, minimizes hospitalizations, ER visits, improves patient adherence with their care plan. Patients get immediate feedback on lifestyle. I think that's huge. Patients love this. When patients have been stabilized and I want to take the scale back from them, I almost have to arm wrestle them to get the scale away. They love this, and they like the scale. I think that in our era of families living away from their elderly parents, it provides family reassurance. I get several phone calls from family members who live maybe in Arizona or outside of the area who feel so much better knowing that their family member is being monitored on a daily basis with this telescale. And this is just what the information looks like when it comes to our computer. The top graph there is their weight, and the bottom number of these yes and no questions that the patients have to answer when they transmit data. And they do that daily, and then we get this nice graph, and we can see when their weight is out of range, and we can see what kind of symptoms they're having associated with that. This is just a patient survey that we have done with our patients on the telescale. The dark green and light green indicate that they agree or strongly agree with the different questions. They love this, as I said. There's never been a problem having patients adjust to using the scale in their home. In fact, we did a sample study back in 2000 when we were starting using the scales, and Nancy was telling me this morning she was involved with calling those 25 patients. They were already in our heart failure program, but we weren't using the scales at that point. And so they picked 25 patients that they thought would be good for the scale. Nancy called 25 of them. Every single one of them agreed to have the scale in their home. So we started with an N of 25, and we didn't have to go any further because all 25 of them agreed from the get-go. We showed an 82% reduction in heart failure hospitalization, an 81% decrease in stay, and a decrease in ER visits. So significant improvement in overall costs because of using the scale and having the people in our program.
Members, this is the slide that really got my attention.
Because we're asked about our outcomes, this is beta blockers and ACE inhibitors are the drugs that are used for treatment of heart failure, and we're able to track our use in this population. In a lot of the studies that are done on heart failure, specifically for heart failure, the best that they can achieve is about 80% use of beta blocker and ACE inhibitors. And in our population, we're able to get almost 100%. The 2% there that we're not getting are people that have an adverse reaction or some other contraindication to taking those medications. And so we're doing what is the standard of care for this population. We also are able to show that patients have an increased ejection fraction. An ejection fraction is how strong the heart muscle pumps. And so people with heart failure have a weak heart and their ejection fraction is low. We're able to show that with this program and with giving them the right medications, we have an improvement in the ejection fraction. What that does is correlate with an improvement in their functional status. So patients that were able to walk 500 feet before having to stop because they got short of breath can now go 2,000 feet before they get short of breath. So it's a significant improvement in their functional status, which then correlates to their ability to participate in the community. Every year we track our admission rate for people on the scale, because when they're not weighing in, we know where they are. So this is very accurate. We can tell if they're not weighing in, and they call us after they've been in the hospital. We know even if they're not right in Duluth and they're hospitalized in Cloquet or some other hospital that isn't part of our system, we're very accurately able to track that information. And year to year, our admission rate is between 5 and 7%. For St. Mary's, I track 6 months readmission rates. So patients that are hospitalized for heart failure, if they're hospitalized within 6 months again for heart failure, I track that information. And our six-month readmission rate is about 6.9% at St. Mary's Hospital. That compares to a national average of 40 to 50%. So the cost savings right there is pretty huge for Medicare and other payers, just keeping these people out of the hospital. This was a study that we did with Blue Cross Blue Shield. They gave us 29 patients that they wanted us to manage in the heart failure program. And these numbers are Blue Cross Blue Shield's numbers. This is what these 29 patients billed Blue Cross for their care for heart failure. So it breaks it down by inpatient, outpatient, ER, professional fees, lab fees, et cetera. 6 months prior to being in the program and 6 months after being in the program. You can see that the significant savings is really the inpatient and ER reduction. So over 6 months on 29 patients, we saved them $1.2 million. We have a plaque thanking us for that. They now, Blue Cross does reimburse us for the scale, so that was worth doing the study. So what do we get compensated for? We do get compensated for the office visits that the nurse practitioners and the physicians do. And so this slide just shows, Ron and I estimated, we see about 200 new patients a year in the program, and we took their 7 to 10 office visits with the labs, EKG, and echoes that we would probably order on these 200 patients per year, and figured that we charge about $6,000 per year per patient. And if we collected all that, we'd get $1.3 million. Unfortunately, we don't collect all that. The 500 patients are the follow-up patients that we see about 4 times a year. And again, we included the lab and probably an echocardiogram that we get yearly on these patients, and what that would equal if we were able to collect all of that. So our total charge is about $4.1 million, but because of contracts with payers and reductions and Medicare reimbursement the way it is, we only collect about $1.8 million of what we're charging. And that's just for the office visits, the lab, the traditional medical care, so to speak. I'm going to talk about why I think telemonitoring really makes financial sense. There is a code for charging for the telescales. There's a rental fee and there's a professional fee. And what the professional fee is, the oversight. And, of course, Medicare doesn't reimburse, but the third-party payers are starting to recognize the importance of this. So we can charge monthly rental fees and professional fees, which equals about $2,800 for the year for the cost of for a patient to have a scale. If they're hospitalized for heart failure, the average cost for one admission is about $6,000. So the third-party payers are starting to recognize the importance of that, and paying for preventive care is starting to make sense. We also look at, from the inpatient side, how this program has affected our financials. One of the representatives talked earlier about the how keeping people out of the hospital affects the inpatient side. Most hospitals are actually losing money on heart failure because these patients are very sick. And we have tracked from the beginning of the program that when patients are hospitalized with heart failure from our heart failure program, that our hospital actually makes a small positive margin. Even though these patients are more ill, their acuity rating is a little higher. Versus patients who hit St. Mary's Hospital with heart failure who aren't a part of our heart failure program, the hospital loses money on those patients. So when hospitalized, heart failure program patients consume less resources than heart failure patients not followed by the program. And as I showed you earlier, they also have lower six-month readmission rates. So it's not that we're just getting them out of the hospital sooner, we're keeping them out of the hospital. So despite positive outcomes, many heart failure outpatient services are not reimbursed for a lot of the work that we do on the outpatient side. And there's little incentive for independent medical groups to provide the best practice. We're lucky at St. Mary's because we're an integrated group, and our bottom line falls is that we have a common bottom line between the inpatient and outpatient settings. I feel very strongly, as Dr. Wood already spoke a little bit about, that current reimbursement rewards failure. It's kind of like not changing your oil on the car regularly, and then when the car crashes, you get a new car. And that's kind of the way the reimbursement is. If you're not paid for the work up front that you do to keep these patients out of the hospital, but if they hit the hospital or they hit the emergency room, then you are reimbursed. It doesn't cover time spent educating patients. It doesn't cover time spent overcoming barriers to care. Many of these patients are frail, elderly people, and they can't see what medication they should take, or they can't figure out how to organize these 10 medications that they have to take a day, several times a day, in a way that helps them take their medication, or they can't pay for their medication. So the time that our nurses spend on the phone overcoming those barriers, recognizing those barriers, and helping those patients achieve the best care is not reimbursed. This just shows you what our charges are for the telescale. $160 a month times 151 scales, this is what we're charged annually for the professional fee. For our rental, we pay $50 a month for 151 scales. So our total is $380,000. And we did get reimbursed last year from some third-party payers to the tune of $16,000, so that was helpful. But we still have a $360,000 deficit that we weren't reimbursed for, that we ate the cost. I'm now going to go over some of the uncompensated costs, and I have to use this because this computer doesn't give me my whole slide. I don't want to miss anything. Starting with our staffing services. Because we have a separate database, we have to have abstractors and database IT people. There's a cost for the NPPA staff. We have nurse practitioner administration time. That's what I'm doing today. We have the medical director fees. We have 4.5 FTEs of RN staff and 3 FTEs. FTE stands for full-time equivalents, I'm sorry. Support staff, which is the CMAs. And then training the staff. We can't just take an RN or a nurse practitioner and put them into this role without providing significant training. And so the staff training that's involved with this. And so our total uncompensated staff is about $780,000. The next slide shows what we've done for community service. We do an annual heart failure presentation and invite local primary care physicians that aren't part of SMDC. I mean, the physicians that are part of SMDC are always invited, but we also invite non-SMDC physicians to this regional presentation. And we also included there the support group and the quarterly newsletter as community service items that we're doing to the cost of about $10,000. We're also involved with research. We are a part of the Minnesota Heart Failure Consortium, which is run out of Hennepin County by Dr. Steve Goldberg. We have quarterly attendance at meetings there. And also we are part of the ICSI group, which stands for Institute for Clinical Systems Improvement, and we're on the Heart Failure Initiative. And that includes the staff of, we have both inpatient and outpatient practitioners and staff attending those meetings. So another $15,000 of uncompensated service. So if you add those all up, you come to $1.1 million that is uncompensated. I think we really need to look at a new model of care delivery. We really need to look at telemonitoring, not just for heart failure, but other chronic diseases as well, diabetes, asthma. As Dr. Wood said, having these devices in the home allows you to be more efficient as a practitioner. They don't always have to have the face-to-face information or look at the patient in order to make good decisions about their care. Doing chronic disease management, which is a different model of care. Getting reimbursement for the work that nurses do. Nurses have been invisible for a long time in all of this, and helping get reimbursement for the education, the time spent, the hours spent. Nurses aren't cheap, and they're starting to be more expensive as the nursing crisis hits us, shortage hits us. It's more of a team approach to care. So having the physicians involved, helping, you know, develop the plan, the accurate diagnosis, having the nurse practitioners do the management, having the RNs do the education, getting the dietitians involved. It's really a team approach to care. And we also need systems to identify patients at risk so we can do early intervention. So one of my pushes with the heart failure program, as I said, most of my patients are sick. They're class 3 or stage C. I want to see the class 2 and class stage B patients so that they never get to stage C. So why should we care about heart failure? Well, it's starting to be a huge problem in the United States. This graph shows you by age and by sex that it's certainly the disease increases with age. And as we all know, all of us baby boomers are aging. And so that's going to be us. The incidence is very high. About 5 million Americans have heart failure. There's 550 new cases annually diagnosed. The incidence is about 10 in every 1,000 for people over the age of 65. A huge cost in healthcare dollars, and it's the single largest expense for Medicare healthcare dollars. And there's a very high one-year mortality rate. And I think part of that is because we're not providing best care early, mm-hmm. that we're not intervening on these people until they're class 3 and class 4 and very ill. And by then, the cat's out of the bag. We know that there's a projected shortage of physicians and nurses. Currently at SMBC, we're recruiting 35 primary care physicians, 52 advanced practice nurses or nurse practitioners, and 61 specialty physicians, 3 of which are cardiologists. So in summary, the St. Mary's Blue Clinic Heart Failure Program continues to provide evidence-based medical care and care management while achieving benchmark clinical outcomes. The healthcare community seeks adequate reimbursement to cover costs associated with disease management programs that demonstrate quality performance outcomes. This is our SMBC model. And in recognition of the chair's love for bicycling, I've included a picture of Lance Armstrong and wanted to use the analogy of what we're doing at St. Mary's. And we're doing this without a bike, and we'd really like to get some wheels under it. And with that, I will take questions, and any of us here can field questions. Thank you.
Any questions? Representative Abler.
Well, this is great. I was just looking around the audience. I thought they came back and said, look, I don't see a lot of the insurance lobbyists here and HMOs, but actually it's too bad. I don't know how to get them to understand some of, not them, they're just spokesmen, but it's, have you had any success with finding ways to backfill what you've lost and to give you, as Dr. Wood talked about, an incentive to do better work? And how has that gone with the pilots? And what do you see for hope on the horizon to get the virus of your good work infected with the rest of the system?
We have seen some changes. One change that we're seeing is that health payers are contacting us and asking us to manage their population of heart failure patients and then offering a capitated system. The current contract that we've entered into is with St. Louis County, and besides our usual charges for the scale and the office visits and labs and such, they're giving us an incentive over that for us to then manage these patients. They've recognized the good work that we do. And is it First Plan? That has also started to talk with us as well.
Mr. Chair, and we've spent our careers working on this, but how do you get so we don't pay people who are doing it the wrong way to move them here? And that's, you're trying to get a little bit of money at 5, 10, 20% bump so you can just stay open. But how do you disincent people who don't do it right? Maybe that's a rhetorical question, but I think that's, if we could get our arms around that, we'd be on this.
Well, Representative Abler, we do have the Community Measurement Project, which puts out in public how they're doing on certain things, and that's a help. But I was certainly overwhelmed with the fact that it looked to me like you were getting an 80% improvement in health for these people, and spending half as much money. No, because the whole healthcare system would do that, we'd be in good shape. Representative Root.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you. That was fantastic. And I'd love to see it replicated in different for different chronic illnesses. It would be wonderful. My question is, and you touched on it a little bit, is that the projected shortage of physicians and nurses, are you finding it difficult to recruit? And I'm wondering where you did your training. If you went here to the university or?
Yeah. I did train at the University of Minnesota. Yes, we are finding it difficult to recruit. Even though we have a nurse practitioner program in Duluth and a nursing program with the College of St. Scholastica, and also Lake Superior College has an RN program, and we are still having difficulties. I have two open full-time positions right now for nurse practitioners, and I have no applicants.
Thank you.
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for scheduling this, and thank you for your work. It's important, and how we translate academic knowledge and success into practice is so hard anyhow with individual practitioners, but it's even harder in the system. And I was intrigued by your thought that it works best in your system because you're both the clinic and the hospitals are together and they're knitted together, which is not a model that is the most common across the state. And is that a challenge that, you know, are you looking to partners in other parts of the state to test out different models of partnership? Because I think, and maybe it's asking others to step up. And the second question was, after you did this successful project with Blue Cross Blue Shield, and not putting the pressure on them, I mean, I think Representative Abler's question was the right question, but, you know, I'll be interested in hearing back if eventually they, within their big, large bureaucracy, take the findings from their own pilot project and implement that. And I'd love to hear if eventually that does work.
The first question, are we partnering with other institutions in the state? We have not. Or maybe Ron, you could speak to them.
Well, what we've done is exported our heart failure program to other communities within our region that will help benefit the acute care organizations in those communities, similar to how we benefit our own acute care organization at St. Mary's. And the sites that Linda had alluded to in her talk, Ashland, Wisconsin, Spooner and Hayward, Wisconsin, and now in Virginia, we're also looking at outreaching to International Falls, Hibbing. So we are expanding the program significantly in our at our outreach sites. So yes, we have taken it to other communities in hopes to benefit the those communities and the healthcare organizations in those communities.
Mr. Siebert, just for the tape, could you state your name?
Ron Siebert.
Thank you.
We also have a one-day preceptorship that we put together, and we have had probably about 100 attendees over the last few years that come and spend a day at the Duluth Clinic, and we go over our protocols and our model and share our program with them. So, and we've had people from all over the United States come for that. We even have somebody from Hawaii come to Duluth, Minnesota.
We should not neglect the most important person here, and that's Mr. Larry Shelton. If you would come down and say a few words.
I would just like to give you my experiences with the heart program. In 2003, I had a massive heart attack, and I spent several weeks in St. Mary's intensive care. And when I came out of there, I walked out of there with only 20% of my heart capacity, and I went home and thought that my life, productive life at 47, was over. I owned several businesses, served on the school board at Proctor, Minnesota, and did a lot of volunteer work. So after a couple, 3 weeks of laying home without any energy to walk to the mailbox and suffering severe depression, my heart surgeon had recommended this heart failure program when I left, and when I left there, I didn't think much of it, but as I laid home and figured that I had to do something, I joined the program and worked with them, and they educated me on what to eat, what not to eat, what exercise programs, and then Linda worked with me on all the different medications. As she said, we're on several, as heart patients, we take several medications. And after about 8 months to a year, I got back to where I could function somewhat normally by adjusting my medicines, changing some of them, and continued, like she said, I saw them every couple weeks. And I finally got back where I could, after a year, I went back to work and started running my businesses again. And now, after 3 years of being in the program, I'm back to 60 hours a week. I returned as the chairman of the Proctor School Board, and I live a pretty normal life. But it's without, as I look back on it now, without their support and their guidance, I don't believe I would have lived a year, or I would have either ended up in a nursing home as a burden to the family and the community, or not lived, one of the two. But it's been a phenomenal program for me. I've got friends that have gone through it that have done well, family that have done well. And I think it's a very important part of recovery from heart disease. Because at 47, I left the hospital thinking my life was over. And now it's been a little more than 3 years, and I am back to 90% of what I could do probably before that happened. And thanks to these people here, these fine people that are dedicated and hardworking. So that's kind of a short history. There's a lot of things that went on in between, but it is a phenomenal program. It's made a big difference in my life, and I am very grateful for it.
Thank you, Mr. Shelton.
Thank you.
Is there another presentation, Mike?
There is. Joseph Grant from SMDC will present information on a potential Medicare demonstration project that SMDC has applied to participate.
Thank you.
Thank you and good afternoon for this opportunity to speak to you briefly about a potential CMS project. To touch upon some of the questions that have been asked earlier.
Could you state your name?
Sorry. I'm Joseph Grant with the St. Mary's Blue Clinic Health System. We intend to expand the success of the CHF program to other chronic diseases, and hopefully will inform the largest payer in the market right now, CMS, by participating in a demonstration project that was authorized under the MMA of 2003. The project is the Medicare Healthcare Quality Demonstration, or Section 646 from that act. This is CMS's invitation to providers to provide a model of care reflecting new approaches to improve patient safety, enhance quality, increase efficiency, and reduce uncertainty and unwarranted variation in practice. Ultimately, from Medicare's perspective, they're looking at examples where patients receive higher quality care at a lower cost to Medicare. There are some common goals both to Medicare and to the providers who may participate in this. First is adopting and using various tools and information technology that follow evidence-based medicine guidelines, best practice guidelines, and shared decision-making with patients and providers. There's a belief that payment methodologies need to be reformed. There's a recognition within CMS and within providers, as touched on earlier by Dr. Wood and Linda Wick, that payments today get in the way of good health care. There's a belief that outcomes need to be measured and that cultural competence needs to be enhanced. The caveat that Medicare has thrown on this is that budget neutrality must be maintained during a 5-year project period. This is directly from the RFP that Medicare issued. At its grandest, particularly if a demonstration is conducted by a regional coalition, the demonstration affords an opportunity to reinvent healthcare. We took a look at this opportunity beginning November of 2005 and realized that there would be strength in working with other partners. So working with the National Institute of Health Policy, Senator Durenberger's group, and Haviland Health Consulting, we were able to submit an application in September, working with 11 other health systems in 7 states. Our goals for the project are really to work in partnership with CMS to create and sustain a payment and regulatory environment that allows providers to do their best work and for patients to achieve and maintain optimal health. It differs from what's happening today by realigning payment structures to reward higher care at lower cost and reducing fragmentation in the delivery system through coordinated care. We hope that it will restructure systems to focus on patients, increase access to primary care, ensure better coordination of complex and chronic care, improve medication management, and then assure that the appropriate systems, both information and financial, are available. Our key organizing concept for this is something we call the medical home. Essentially, a medical home is a team of providers working with patients and families to develop and implement care plans, similar to what we're doing with our CHF program. It would include preventive care, chronic disease management, care coordination, including multiple providers such as nursing homes and hospitals, and palliative care. The key structural change to this piece in order to make this project work is a modification of the reimbursement model to remove financial disincentives and allow for shared savings. Our timeline, the application has been submitted as of the end of September. We are currently waiting for the response from CMS. It is being reviewed along with other applications from across the country. If CMS expressed interest in moving forward with our project, we will begin the negotiation period with CMS, work on any issues that were identified in the process, develop our required protocols, and submit those for approval, and develop other relationships with a tentative start date of mid-calendar year 2008 for a 5-year demonstration project. And that's a brief overview and update.
Are there any brief questions for Mr. Grant? I don't see any. So thank you, Mr. Grant. And I think this Medicare project they're looking at is an indication that Medicare is concerned about the payment system and doesn't seem to be working the way they want it to. Mm-hmm. So I'd like to thank Dr. Wood and all the people from St. Mary's and particularly Larry Shelton for coming down.
Jim, you have just a comment. Yeah. Look how gracefully that place moves, you know. A year to talk about it, and well, maybe 2 weeks, and then 5 years. And, I mean, holy cow. We think we're slow here. So we're pretty feet.
So thank you for coming down, and we greatly appreciate your presentation. The Commissioner of Health wants to give us a few pieces of information, I think. Commissioner Mandernack, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I am Commissioner Diane Mandernack, and I'm pleased to be here today to talk about funding priorities in the governor's budget for the Minnesota Department of Health. Having listened to the last two presentations, I get a little excited in terms of the possibilities of what we can and hopefully could accomplish in the health system if we can just kind of reinvent it and turn it on its head a little bit. In a moment, I will ask staff to provide you with the details on the initiatives that are in the budget. I'm not sure whether we will have time for that today, but that will be the next step of the process. As you recall from my visit here a few days ago, we talked about what the mission of the health department is, and that is to protect, maintain, and improve the health of all Minnesotans. I believe that the proposals that we have before you today really move to meet that mission. The first priority that I want to talk about is the Governor's Healthy Connections Initiative. I know that you had testimony, heard testimony on this the other day, so we're not going to cover this initiative again today. But I do want to remind you that the Health Insurance Exchange, which is a single point of entry for the individual insurance market, and a key element of that proposal is included in the Health Department's budget. The second priority that I want to highlight is the e-health grant, and I think we had a little bit of an indication in the previous presentation on the value of the electronic medical record. The introduction of the health information technologies, specifically the electronic health record, really is transforming healthcare. When we talk about the electronic health record, it enhances the availability of the patient data, and it provides the decision-making tools that are really there to improve the clinical care, the quality, the safety, and I would suggest the consumer satisfaction. It puts everything at the point of service and in the hands of the provider who needs it at the moment when, in fact, they need it. The eHealth Grant Initiative builds on what was provided last year by the legislature, the $1.5 million in funding. What we learned from that process, from that grant cycle, is that there's a significant unmet need in rural and underserved healthcare community for the funding of the interoperable systems. Particularly the independent practices, many of these are located in rural communities, need help in moving this initiative along. One of my real biases is I think we have to be very, very careful that we don't end up with a two-tier system in Minnesota where the major systems have the electronic record and then our outstate facilities in rural communities are not able to participate. The final priority I want to highlight is the Merck Grant. And since its inception in 1998, the Merck Grant Program, and this stands for Medical Education and Research Costs, has really provided some critical financial resources to support the clinical training of health professionals, and this is in all settings across the state. We have worked hard, we have ensured over the years that the grant funding follows the trainees, so that the training of medical professionals has really moved from inpatient to outpatient, so has the funding, because it follows the trainee. We believe that this is a key component, a key principle of the Merck program. One of the things we are concerned about is the potential changes in federal regulations have put the federal matching funds at risk. So this initiative will allow us to meet the policy goals of the Merck program and maintain, hopefully, some level of federal participation. So these are the main areas of priority. There are a few of our proposals, the ones that are germane to this particular committee. Obviously, our other initiatives are equally important, but are not under the purview of this particular committee at this point in time. So with that, I would call staff if you have time. Otherwise, we will we'll have them back here to walk through the detail for your next session.
You want to come back? Or?
They like being here.
Any questions for the commissioner? Well, thank you for coming here, and I apologize again for the delay. Some of these things go a little longer than you think.
No need for apology, Mr. Chairman. It was very interesting. Thank you.
Ms. Representative,
before I got it, before was on that previous discussion, I think it's a pleasant coincidence you were here to hear that other dialogue. Since you're in the Department of Health, is there anything that that your department can do to encourage the adoption of some of these wonderful ideas that are coming along, that it takes a risk, and a person who has money and risk to find the ways to do it, and so then they can be somehow used more?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Abler, I think when you listen to this type of presentation, it highlights the innate inequity, the brokenness of the system. What the health department tries to do, we're the regulatory agency, we try to get out of the way in initiatives like this, but so much of it really does come down to the reimbursement system that is currently in place. We reimburse for procedure rather than outcome. And until we get to the point where we can kind of turn that on its head and do something differently, I think that it takes a great deal of discussion. As the chairman knows, we've been talking about this for a long time. The role of the health department is to make sure we don't put barriers in the way of progress.
Any other questions? Thank you, Commissioner, for appearing here with us today. Meeting adjourned.